Hi and welcome to the Stefan Levera podcast focused on Bitcoin and Austrian economics. Today for episode 107, we are talking with Jeremy Welch and Jameson Lopp of Casa. But first, let me introduce the sponsors of the podcast. Check out Kraken, one of the world's leading Bitcoin exchanges. I'm really impressed with the way they have operated consistently with a strong focus on security over the years. They've acted ethically in the space as well under Jesse Powell's leadership. They're one of the longest standing Bitcoin exchanges and they're consistently rated the best. They've got high trading volume and low fees with no minimum or hidden fees. Kraken also have 24/7 support, and on the institutional and solution side, they are providing best-in-class accounting, reconciliation, and reporting services for cryptocurrency hedge funds, asset managers, and fund administrators. Kraken have an OTC desk for those higher-touch, large block trades. They offer 5 fiat currencies and also offer margin and futures trade. To learn more and sign up, go to the Kraken link in the show notes. Next up is Unchained Capital. They're doing Bitcoin financial services, and their two main products are a 2 of 3 keys multi-signature vault and a Bitcoin collateralized loan. So with the vault, remember, it's difficult to use multi-signature right now, but Unchained Capital have a very easy solution, and you can use Trezor or Ledger, and you're still maintaining control with your 2 keys, and you can distribute those keys to improve your security a little bit. And we'll also be talking with Dhruv Bansal from Unchained Capital on the podcast shortly, so keep an eye out for that episode. Remember, Unchained Capital also offer Bitcoin collateralized loans, so you can get USD liquidity without selling your Bitcoins and incurring that capital gains event, which might be better for you from a tax point of view. So they store that under a dedicated multi-sig address under collaborative custody. So if you want to learn more and sign up, go to the Unchained Capital link in the show notes. So for this episode today, we are carrying on with the Bitcoin custody series. And this episode was actually recorded together in person at Riga just before the Baltic Honey Badger conference the first day. So we're speaking with Jeremy Welch, the CEO of Casa, and Jameson Lopp, the CTO of Casa. Now, they've both been on the show previously. Jeremy was on SLP 26 and Jameson was on SLP 43. So keep an eye for this conversation. We're talking about some of the different security decisions made from Casa's perspective and how they have designed their different services and how they're thinking about security, which they have recently released in the Casa Wealth Secure Protocol document. Here is the interview. Jeremy and Jameson, welcome back to the show.
It's fun. How are you, man?
Good.
Great to be here.
So we are recording here in Riga just before the Baltic Honey Badger 2019. So, look, guys, I wanted to get you guys back on and talk about the Casa Security or Casa Wealth Protocol, rather, and also just, you know, what's going on with Casa these days. So Jeremy, you just want to just give a quick overview on where the company's at and what's going on?
Sure. So just this past week, about a week ago, we released this Casa Wealth Security Protocol. We've had some other updates around the multisig side and also around Sats app and around some updates to the node. But one of the big things we've done the last few weeks is release this document that really expands through the full security model, the features that we chose. We actually chose to go ahead and elucidate all of the features that we didn't choose to use too, because there are specific reasons why we did those. And this should just help. There's a lot that we usually walk our clients through. Anyone that comes to us, most of our clients actually know all the things that are in the stock already. But for the kind of majority of the population, majority of the Bitcoin community, they're not aware of this. And we just thought that putting it in document form, making it really easy to access, and then also update. And as we learn, as we work with customers, we'll update this from year to year. But it makes it really easy to kind of have a kind of rule set to really kind of gauge against. So,
yeah, I mean, this is part of what I think is like the real value add of Casa as a system, where we've focused a lot on both the technical and the like user interface design, such that a user could just come into Casa and start using it and basically have this huge benefit of the wealth of knowledge of like 50 pages of technical decisions that have been made around the security model. But of course, we have people who are securing a large amount of wealth within our system. And in many cases, they want to then further dig down into to actually understanding why the system is designed the way that it is. And this, like Jeremy said, basically explains those decisions that we've already had to describe to a lot of our customers over the past couple of years.
Fantastic. Yeah, and I've had a chance to read through the document. I thought it was really nicely written. In the document, you speak through the three alternatives, right? So you've got kind of do-it-yourself, custodial storage, and then other commercial sovereign storage systems. And another thing that struck out to me is also just the comparison with Glacier Protocol. So my previous interview was with Diogo Monaco, the maintainer of Glacier Protocol, and it strikes me, like, as I was reading the document, the CASA document, it's essentially talking about how there are certain trade-offs that we make using Glacier Protocol. I think one of the key ones is the difficulty of usability and the difficulty of setting up. And I think that's one thing that I view CASA as doing, is you guys are really helping with the usability of a high security option. Do you want to discuss about that?
Sure. So this, everything we built around the CASA Wealth Security Protocol is in direct response to and is kind of an extension of the learnings from Glacier Protocol. So Jacob Lyles, who created the Glacier Protocol, is on the team, helped us write this document, helped us really pull a lot of the resources together whenever we built this. But we actually used Glacier Protocol as a kind of basis to start working from. And a lot of companies have done this in the past. A lot of even exchange companies used Glacier Protocol early on as foundations for their cold storage. And we just saw that it was, it's rock solid, but it's very hard to implement and execute and set up, where we wanted something that, usability, if we go through kind of our threats, and we kind of identified these 13 core threats. One of them is, just working from like what we call a child or pet attack, or these kind of usability issues of needing to be kind of idiot proof in a sense. Right? And Glacier Protocol is just really extensive. And so from that perspective, it will always sit. We actually are, I don't think we've announced that publicly yet, that we are kind of co-maintaining with Diogo and those guys with Glacier Protocol. But we kind of did the learning from there, and then we've tried to extend it, and specifically in the direction of where, the Anchorage guys, and they built a phenomenal product, phenomenal company, and they're really focused on the enterprise side. We're kind of extending in the side of the consumer and the side of the individual small teams for kind of maximum security. And we talk wealth security instead of just Bitcoin, because Bitcoin is the core focus and that's what we're focused on, but it really is around, Bitcoin as data, and these threats are going to be true of any type of data kind of going forward, and kind of personal wealth. But
I think that you could potentially describe CASA as seeking to find the optimal practical security solution. When it comes to security, if you're really trying to go for like fully trustless, fully minimizing the risk of anything going wrong, then you take it to the extreme. You basically can get to the point of, well, you basically need to be writing your own software, or at least auditing all the software you're using. And then even the more extreme is, well, on the hardware side, you basically need to be like fabricating your own hardware to make sure that nobody has tampered with that. Because, we're at the level of complexity these days with the hardware that nobody really knows everything that's going on. And so the question is like, where do you draw the line of, well, I'm going to assume that everything below this level is working and can be trusted. And for us, we're kind of raising the line a lot higher and saying, well, we're going to assume that, if we spread out your key generation and management across like multiple different providers, then you're lowering the risk to a point that you don't really need to worry about things like supply chain attacks or low-level hardware issues.
Yeah. And to me, even reading the wealth security protocol document, it came clear to me there was this concept of defense in depth, right? It's saying, how do you set up your security in such a way that any individual failure will not compromise you totally, that you can afford one failure or before you lose your wealth?
You need to have a more flexible system, because Bitcoin and the sovereignty that it gives to you is also highly inflexible and unforgiving when it comes to mistakes. And that's why it seems like the bigger risk of loss in these systems is actually due to ignorance and user mistakes as opposed to actual attack and theft.
Right, yeah. So there's that idea that you're more likely to screw yourself out of your own coins if you're trying to do multi-sig and you make a mistake with it. I think even Andrew Chow on the previous episode mentioned that he had difficulties trying to get multi-signature with multi-hardware wallets working, and he is himself a quite competent technical developer. So if it's hard for him, it's, you know, it's going to be hard for anyone, right? So there's definitely some components around that. Let's talk a bit about some of the design principles from the document. So you've got here minimal knowledge.
Yeah, and it's there's a lot around minimizing data on Casa. It's both the for privacy reasons, but also for can't be evil reasons, right? That's one of our kind of core company principles. But we have a set of system design principles. And anybody, we're touching on a few things from the document. Anybody can go download this. You just Google Casa Wealth Security Protocol, or I think it's keys.casa/wealth-security-protocol. I think
that's what the URL.
But you can check this out and kind of follow along. But there's a lot more here. But kind of the high level there is that Elena has this term don't collect what you can't protect. And for most companies, most, you know, even just from the side of people exploiting it for their own purposes, this can't be evil principle is what we're talking about there. You need to minimize data. So minimal knowledge just really means that we're going to have minimal knowledge overall of data, period. And usability as security is another one. Just thinking about export support, it's not just about even like the software. It is about the integrations of the data, but it's also about working with humans and humans being part of that system too, and having experts. Sovereignty is a principle. Incentive alignment, again, that kind of aligns with can't be evil. If we can't even attack you, or an internal employee can't even attack you, then that just changes the logic tremendously. If the data is not even there, it changes the logic tremendously versus if a kind of internal employee is going to have to be tested regularly, whether they want to exploit data. So like keeping the system design principles and then looking at the total number of threats. And we had about 13 total threats that we consider is how we then chose the kind of selected features.
Yeah. And there's also the principle of usability is security. So did you want to touch on that around how in making it more usable, you actually are making people more secure? So quick example, I think it's probably fair to say a lot of people have looked at Glacier but have not executed Glacier because it takes a certain level of patience, diligence to execute. And I think that is a key point from Casa the way.
Well, and basically every step that you have to take is a potential mistake. So, you know, the simpler you can make it, the more... When I think of usability, I think of when we're building actual software interfaces that humans are using, you are creating a series of paths that a user can go through. And at Casa, we're trying to limit it to paths that include the best practices, that include a lot of these security principles, so that what you're really doing is you are trying to throw away as many foot guns as possible, within the like infinite number of possible decisions that a user could make when they're setting up and executing their own storage. So many of these paths make it possible for you to screw up in a catastrophic way. And we're basically just trying to, you know, create guardrails that prevent the user from even going off on those paths in the first place.
While still maintaining the sovereignty. That was like an important point. And that's why this kind of full system design principles, you have to keep them in balance. And it really does have to be balanced, because there are certain things you can do to improve usability, but that take away control from the end user. Going fully centralized, it's way more usable. I mean, let's be frank. It's just, you know, Coinbase and just throwing someone a regular login is way more usable on the surface, but it immediately takes away sovereignty, immediately takes away control. It immediately creates a can't be evil situation to where, you know, someone could take coins. And so doing that balance of making sure it's usable while at the absolute extreme that we can, while also maintaining that sovereignty, is really important while minimizing data. And we've even gone as far, even from the legal structure of the company, we have this open data policy, our privacy policy. We kind of wrote a totally new type of privacy policy And that's open source. Other companies can copy that. We're trying to go through kind of every step of the way to build up this stack in terms of the design of the overall system and the incentives even for the internal employees to, again, address these 13 threats.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the, I guess, what are some of the big threats in your mind? What were some of the ones that are most obvious for the user? So I guess just off the list here, there's a few. SIM hijacking, that's a big one lately. Supply chain attack, that's something where, you know, a lot of people are concerned about that and trying to have different hardware wallets and different software that they're working with. Data credential loss, or even being attacked on the platform that you're using. Did you have any that you wanted to kind of highlight?
Well, I mean, I think that of the ones that are listed, you know, the most common one is just simple data loss. And so that's why we believe having, you know, a geographically distributed set of hardware devices that are easy for the user to visualize and think about, you know, how are these actually distributed, that gives you a level of redundancy and robustness that is going to exceed, you know, 99% of other people who are just keeping all their keys in one place.
Right. And I suppose let's just for, I think most listeners might have, you know, heard the earlier episodes, but just for the, in case they haven't, the basic overview, you've got the silver and gold, which is the two of three basic multisig. And my understanding there is they have one hardware wallet and they've got one key on their phone. And then one key is the CASA recovery key in that model. Mm-hmm. And then taking it up a notch to the, is it platinum and diamond? And that is the $1,800 level and the $5,000 level. That is a 3 of 5 setup. We have three hardware wallets in that model. There is one key held on the user's mobile phone, and the fifth key is held by is the CASA recovery key. So I guess let's just talk to maybe the 2 of 3 model. I think one concern I've heard from Bitcoiners is that, oh, hang on, does CASA have two of the three keys? How can I be sure that I hold, you know, 2 of 3?
Well, you can ensure that you hold 2 of 3. We also have export functionality on the mobile key. I suppose, however, it's impossible to prove that CASA doesn't have the mobile key. That is one thing that you'd have to quote unquote trust us on.
Right.
And so, you know, this is another good reason of why, you know, there are trade-offs here. You know, we do intend to add ability to have two different hardware devices so you could then have a greater assurance that you have two of the keys and there's no way CASA could have 2 of 3. But right now, that assurance is best provided by the 3 of 5 model.
Got it.
And we kind of rolled this out intentionally from the 3 of 5, where we were able to build up a user base and work directly with clients. We have direct client relationships. It is kind of like a private banking relationship. We learn a lot from client preferences. We'd done a tremendous amount of testing before we rolled it out to people publicly, but then we also learned a ton from even just the first several months. And we're now over a year of being public. It's, I guess it's almost like 1.5 years of being public. And all of that wealth of knowledge, we've kind of scaled up. We always intended to scale, and we actually have a single key, a mobile key as well. It's a single key. It's on the phone. That's actually used in it's the same key that's shared with our Sats app. So, if you want, Sats app is just really fast spending, and Keymaster is the kind of full multisig. But even the way we rolled that out is we, again, started with the 3 of 5 most premium multisig, and then we slowly rolled out. We had 2 of 3, the single key, slowly rolled those out. We rolled out the 2 of 3 specifically to gold customers first to make sure that that was usable. We also, you know, we mentioned before the multi-location, multi-device, multi-sig model. The reason around that, again, is in terms of these 13 threats, that model is what mitigates those threats the best. And there's a weird trade-off where with the mobile device, if you're going to use a mobile device, from the principle of the usability side, you actually want to maximize usage as soon as you decide to even use it, because of the fact that you can also maximize kind of usability. Now, that mobile device as a single device is your phone is potentially connected to the internet. We do have customers that choose to keep that off at all times, never really connect to the internet, and that effectively does act similarly to a hardware wallet. But it's effectively just a really fancy hardware wallet. But we, you know, for most people, they keep it as a regular key. And people have asked us about that question too. What that comes down to is that, you know, it's also true that Apple or Google, and most, you know, it's either a Google phone or an Apple phone that people are using, you know, they could even try to exploit that key. And as soon as you put that key on the platform, you want to maximize the features that are available there. So we've done that now on the phone. And for the 2 of 3, it's specifically designed. It's not designed to hold millions of dollars. It is designed to hold somewhere between, say, $1,000 and around $100,000, sometimes less. We do have people that, you know, put even a little less than $100,000 on the 3 of 5, right? So we have, there's a range of what people are comfortable with, but it is designed to be an entry level version of like just getting, you know, getting started with multi-sig. That's why we decided, hey, let's, you know, we will use the mobile key and then one hardware wallet. And for most people that had started using this, they'd never used multi-sig before. So it was already a learning experience. We had a lot of people that upgraded immediately after, and they were like, oh yeah, I get it now why there need to be multiple keys. We will be rolling out a version that does have the two hardware wallets, but we wanted heavy testing around just that single version first before we do that. But you know, these are great questions, and yeah. The community has been, is always phenomenal about asking and figuring out these kind of nooks and crannies of questions. And again, that's why we released this document, is that there's a lot more even beyond some of these questions that customers are asking. And so we just want to kind of constantly put these forward and bring these for ourselves and have that level of transparency. And so even as we're adding more features, we expect to get a lot more of these questions.
Yeah, sure. And I think it might be good just for the listeners who are not familiar, just to understand what is the way the mechanism works. So they might be thinking, oh, do I need to bring all three keys into one place at one time? But actually, it's more like you individually do the signatures. Do you want to talk through the process?
Yeah. So, you know, when you're creating a transaction with the Keymaster app, actually initializing, it's like any other transaction. You can scan a QR code, you can manually input data, but basically you set those initial details of the amount and the output destination, and then you'll apply your initial signature there with the key that's on the device. And you know, most likely using either, you know, biometric or face ID or PIN input to basically unlock the mobile device so that you can access the key, which we keep secured via the secure hardware elements that are on the phone. And so then what you have is a partially signed transaction. It's not valid for broadcasting on the Bitcoin network. You then have to go figure out, you know, what other devices do I want to use to add a sufficient number of signatures that it becomes valid? And essentially you just, you know, tap within the app on the device you want to use, and you say, hey, I want to add another signature from here. We'll then, you know, generate a short-lived unique link that you can use to essentially go find that device wherever it is, plug it into a laptop, click on the link, add the signature, and then continue that process until everything is done. And of course, it can get more complicated if you've lost devices and need to have help from Casa. That enters into a different, you know, logical like recovery process. But under normal circumstances, you're basically just going to be traveling around, getting enough hardware devices that you can reach that threshold. And the other thing about making this a really usable system is that we also have health checks available. We have the ability for the user to essentially do key rotations and swap out devices that get lost or broken or compromised without even having to reach out to Casa for help. It's just a simple wizard that you can walk through within the app.
And this ties into, you know, even more of a reason to use the mobile device, is that we realize that people carry their mobile devices with them everywhere. And out of any, you know, arguably sometimes even more than a birth certificate or a social security card or any, you know, government ID, people keep track of their phone always on their person. And whether it's Candy Crush data or some, you know, maybe it's a favorite photo or something, there are valuables, data valuables that are already on those phones, and people treat them very personally, and they protect those devices, and from that side, you know, people usually have it on them, and so if they're traveling from one location, say it's a home, to an office, or to this third location that could be even in a different city, they're going to have their phone on them. They're going to use that as a communications tool. And so using that as the good tool to be totally asynchronous and sign, you could sign kind of the first one on one day, go 2 or 3 days later if you wanted to in a totally different city and signing. And then you've maintained the distance between those two signings. And within that time span, that also means an attacker has to maintain that distance. It is true that an attacker could hold you at gunpoint or do something more aggressive, but even in that case, they're still going to have to go these distances. And the more time that's, you know, we're just raising the bar there, the more time that's required to go these distances, and the more people and places you have to go, the higher likelihood that someone gets caught, someone gets noticed. You could, you know, whether it's actually kind of saying safe words, and we even have, like, that's part of our service around this, is we even have safe words and specific process and emergency lockdown buttons and all these other features that are built in. But it comes to that usability of having the asynchronous nature where you can go different places, but having that usability to where you're always kind of seeing the command center kind of on the phone.
Yeah, I think that's the thing as well, that maybe it might be apparent that a customer can sign up in a more pseudonymous way. Can you talk to that?
Sure. So, you know, at Casa, we are not a bank or a financial institution. We're a software service provider. Within the context of actually managing keys, Casa only ever has one out of N of your key set. And those keys are always kept completely offline and requires manual human recovery process to be gone through, usually a process that can take multiple days. This is also, you know, configurable by each user and how they want that to be done on the Casa side. But the general gist of it is that Casa is going to be helping the user help themselves is the best way that I know how to put it. The downside to this is that, you know, whenever you're into a situation where you are not taking the time or don't have the level of knowledge that you can do everything all by yourself without asking anyone for help, obviously that's going to be the best proxy. But if you want to save time, if you want to have expert guidance, then there has to be some sort of communication. There has to be at least some sort of, you know, pseudonymous email address or other communication endpoint for us to have back and forth. So while we are not a financial institution, we don't do AML, KYC, we don't actually care about your government identity, we do need to have some way to communicate with you in case something goes wrong. You know, if, like Jeremy said, if you hit the emergency lockdown and we basically refuse to allow any signatures to be added for anything, then you'll need to go through a process in order for us to unfreeze the account. Or if you lose a sufficient number of devices that you need Casa to dig the cold storage key out and sign it, you'll need to go through additional processes, because at that point, if we believe that you may have been compromised, you know, we need to ask for some other, you know, non-identifying questions, but some sort of authentication questions, whether it's, you know, things that you know, special phrases or words, or even, you know, photos of either yourself or objects, or, you know, it's basically any type of unique identifiers that you are comfortable with using that would be difficult, if not impossible, for an attacker to replicate.